Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of March. We're pleased to have as our guest the first hour today a gentleman who's been described as one of Britain's most distinguished soldiers. General Sir Rupert Smith is our guest. He is the author of The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World. He's had a 40-year career in the British Army. He commanded the UK Armored Division in the 1990-91 Gulf War. He commanded UN forces in Bosnia. He was in Northern Ireland from 96 to 99, then served as Deputy Supreme Allied Commander in NATO. He retired in the year 2002. One of the reviews of the book says that other writers have failed to understand, as Smith does, that we live in a new era, a new world not made by terrorists or Muslim fundamentalists, but by the absence of major democracies, most obviously in the U.S. and U.K., of serious and informed foreign policy discussion on the changing nature of war and international relations. We seem to require British generals to instruct us in what British and American politicians have too long ignored and what scholars have not yet addressed sufficiently. We'll be welcoming for phone calls for General Sir Rupert Smith. And our number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee number is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. General Sir Rupert Smith, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Very much, and good morning.
Yes, good morning to you. It's so hard to be listening to the news. I'm sure this is true in the UK as well, but every single day now we're getting news of more and more casualties in Iraq, of bombings yesterday at bookstores, in marketplaces, etc. It is just very, very depressing news, and there is no end in sight. Is there any way to turn this around?
As simply as you asked the question, no, I regret. I would like to make a distinction that even if what I say in the book about war has changed, the actual nature of fighting, the actual bit of conflict, is as nasty and as bloody and creates as many casualties as it ever did.
Mm-hmm.
What's changing is the purpose for which we are fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we've got to change the way we think about things. And, of course, what you're being depressed about, if I can put it in these terms, in the nature of the question you ask, is that, of course, every life lost, whether it be an Iraqi or an American or British soldier or a civilian on the street, is a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But what is depressing us is that this effort is not achieving the results we expected.
Right.
We are not arriving at the consequence that we expected to when we started this venture. And it's to change the way of thinking so that we enter into these things in a rather more coherent fashion that I was part of the reason the book was written.
Mm-hmm. You write that Americans and British dispatched forces to Iraq in 2003 capable of defeating Hussein's army, but quite unfit to act as an occupation and reconstruction force. What is it? How do they need to be better informed? And if you're going to carry out this kind of a military force against a country, it seems to me as though everybody would think about what to do to reconstruct a country and how to act as an occupying force, that would be a natural. How could that not be done?
Well, our paradigm or model of war that we have in our heads and is a consequence of our historical experience and our institutions have all grown up to prosecute and prosecute successfully. I call in the book Industrial War.
Yes.
And in that, the purpose that you are trying to achieve by military force is to actually impose the result you want from the political confrontation that gives rise to the war in the first place. You impose your solution, as it were, by force of arms. This paradigm has changed in my argument, and the tipping point of the change being the use of the atomic bombs in at the end of the Second World War in 1945, and we now are in operate within a paradigm which I call war amongst the people, mm-hmm. where you are using your military forces to set a condition in which other agencies can achieve the political result you want. Now, the first thing, and if you're going to do that, then the first thing you've got to do is to recognize that your military aren't going to solve the problem. The military are going to be the part, a very important part, perhaps, of the supporting activities. And therefore, if you're going to take Iraq as an example, you enter Iraq and defeat their forces, you haven't won at all. What you've done is started to create the condition in which you might have won. Mm-hmm. One being to produce the situation in which there was a democracy and the rule of law in Iraq to an extent that we approved of it. Now, this we made no effort demonstrably to make that so once we had achieved the, I say no effort, no successful effort, to achieve that once that military condition of entry had been achieved. Mm-hmm. And the institutional point was that we left the Department of Defense responsible for it.
Mm-hmm. So we thought that this shock and awe, this overwhelming use of military force would be enough, and then democracy would take care of itself?
Mm. Well, shock and awe actually requires the other party to cooperate with you. I've never cared for that sort of description of military planning, since it's the other party that's got to be shocked and awed, and if he doesn't cooperate, then your plan's failed. One of the things that industrial war thinking has led us to is to assume things about our enemy, mm-hmm. That are demonstrably false in the circumstances of war amongst the people. A recent example of war amongst the people, which is it has got a it's a long-running confrontation. It's that between Israel and Hezbollah over the northern borders of Israel and Lebanon. And there you can see that being played out in a conflict of about a month in July and August of last year, where again, Hezbollah just would not cooperate, as it were, with the Israeli Defense Forces' actions.
Why is it?
And why should your enemy cooperate with you? You however much you may dislike him and his object and his ideology or whatever, one must understand him much as one might as another boxer in a ring, as your opponent, and respect him as such.
Why is it, General Smith, that we hold fast to this this industrial war model instead of, because we've had Bosnia, we've had Vietnam, we've had other conflicts here in which that industrial war model doesn't hold, and you would have thought we would have learned from that. Why are we so tied to that model?
Well, I think this is the nature of large institutions. Mm. And when I'm talking of institutions, I'm talking of those of governance, those of the armed forces, the international bodies we form from them, like NATO or a UN force, or the coalition. They have a mind, as it were, of their own. And you have only to look at in the commercial world to see how sometimes very large institutions are finding it extremely difficult to adapt to what everyone else reckons they can see very clearly. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the automobile industry in the United States would be a case in point. That in the United Kingdom has almost disappeared in the same circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I think the short answer, which I've said it rather long, it's an institutional mindset that has to be changed, and this is always rather difficult to do. And the examples you gave me of Bosnia and other wars amongst the peoples, what happens is that we give them another label, so they get called peace support operations, mm-hmm. because this isn't really what we do. And we put them in another box.
What about, you talk about political problems, that we're using military force to address political problems. Tell me more about what those, in center on Iraq, because that's front and center right now, what kinds of political problems do we need to address, and what institutions do we have in place on a world level or on a country level that could address those problems?
Well, I'm using the word political in its broadest sense. And I take it your question is addressed by military force as opposed to any other political issues. As it were, theoretical model, when two political bodies, such as states, are in confrontation over some matter, a border or fishing rights or whatever, it can come, if they're not prepared to abide by some rules or laws or adjudication, one or other party may seek to use military force to resolve the matter.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, we're trying to resolve territorial disputes by armed force has proved to be nugatory, and by and large, since 1945, the boundaries of the world have stayed pretty well stable.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is that other political problems, perhaps freedom from colonialism, a revolution within the state, a condition so that other ideas of yours can be affected, and then military force starts to get used. We tend to put this under labels like terrorism, which is the nature of the force being used, the purpose of the force being used, rather than to understand what is the outcome desired by its use.
Mm-hmm.
Of an answer?
Yes.
And so, of course, we then have to defeat that if that's happening to us.
We're going to welcome phone calls for General Rupert Smith, and we'll do this in a moment. His book is The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World. His assessment of Iraq, one reviewer said, is incredibly valuable. A retired British general who understands how the very nature of war has changed. And here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. The central thesis of the book, Industrial War, the all-out sort of struggle that disfigured the 20th century, is dead. Instead, we fight among the people. He writes about the character of modern conflict, what the war among the people means. He talks about the war in Iraq in some detail. He talks about Bosnia, where he commanded UN forces in 1995. He's had a 40-year career in the British Army and was Deputy Supreme Allied Commander in NATO, retiring in 2002. Did I give you the number? Here it is, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. General Rupert Smith, the author of The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World, is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about that remarkable scene in Selma, Alabama over the weekend where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama spoke at churches just a couple blocks away from each other about how Bloody Sunday influenced their lives, how the civil rights movement influenced their lives and made it possible for them to be speaking to those congregations and to be commemorating the 42nd anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Donna Brazil will be with us. Donna was the campaign manager for Al Gore, and Ronald Walters will join us, director of the African American Leadership Institute. So it should be a really interesting hour. Join us, hour number two, as well as hour number one. And if you'd like to join us on air this hour, please feel free, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. General Sir Rupert Smith, one of Britain's most distinguished soldiers, is our guest. His book, The Utility of War, is about achieving a workable strategy in a complex world. One review said that it deserves to be read at the highest levels. Can we talk about objectives for a moment here, General Smith? And I'm interested, when you talk about defining objectives clearly before you undertake some kind of military action, center these on Iraq for a moment. Do you think that we have a clear idea now of what our objectives are? Did we have an idea of what our objectives were? And the second part of the question is, who's supposed to decide what the objectives are?
Well, let's deal with it step by step. The objectives in war amongst the people must be understood as being twofold. The first is your confrontational, and if you've read the book, so you know that there's this, I divide this up into a confrontation within which a conflict nests. The confrontation is the essentially political result that you're trying to achieve, and the conflictual objectives are to support your achievement of that political result. And the two must be coherent. Now, firstly, your objective of your confrontational objective is essentially one of winning the will of the people, mm-hmm. the intentions of the people. And your military activity should be being done and to achieve objectives that support this, or at the very least, do not erode that support, that capture of their will. The opponent, of course, is doing everything in his power to dislocate that coherence of that political objective and that military activity. And they're rather good at dislocating our military activity from our political purpose, and we're not very good at making sure ours are coherent, and we're much less good at dislocating the opponent's military activities from their political purpose. Now, to be more specific and go to the Iraq, no, I don't think we have been very clear as to those two objectives and the coherence of the activity. Let's go to the very beginning. The objective was, in various forms of words, to establish a democratic Iraq that mm-hmm. we approved of. The military objective was to defeat the armed forces of Iraq, occupy the country, and unseat Saddam Hussein. Now, we were unable to make those two objectives coherent.
Mm-hmm.
And our opponents, who are various, and here it gets difficult,
yes,
because we
yes.
unleashed a situation where there was, the opponents can appear in a number of forms and with varyingly contradictory objectives of their own, and this makes it extremely difficult. But at least in the early stages, many of our actions served to further dislocate our political purpose from our military activity. Abu Ghraib being a particular example, but mm-hmm. not the only one. And again, I write in the book as to how this has to be understood not only in the actual theatre, or as I describe it, as the like a Roman circus, the amphitheatre, but in the world who look on through the media and particularly the television services, they're all forming an opinion as to what's happening. And this is colouring their actions and reactions as well, which further complicate the matter.
Mm-hmm.
You then asked the second question, and I can't quite remember what it was.
No, I can't either at this point. It'll come to mind sometime during the next half hour. Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486. Oh, I know what it was. Who makes the decisions? Who should be making the decisions?
Well, now, again, one of the characteristics of these wars amongst the people is that we don't do these operations, as a general rule, as states. States may be involved, mm-hmm. but you conduct them in some form of multinational grouping,
mm-hmm.
And or the opponents aren't states either. And so let's take Israel, which is operating as on its own, but it's opposed to groups such as Hezbollah and Hamas, who are not states.
Mm-hmm.
And we have cases like, say, Iraq at the moment, where we have a coalition, and this takes form on a strategic level of the United States leading it, and there's such as the United Kingdom and other countries involved. But it's also a coalition within the theatre, where you have got the Iraqis and their armed forces involved. And there are other less comfortable alliances, perhaps with the Kurdish forces and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And this then has an effect on the higher level coalition, where Turkey isn't in quite the same point of view as America over what's going on in the Kurdish areas of Iraq, and so on and so forth. So it is extremely difficult to form these objectives in these coalitions. And you, to take Hezbollah and Israel in last summer, there the Israelis had great difficulty in formulating an objective, and
mm-hmm.
And we witnessed the result as, mm-hmm. as a consequence. Their actions became incoherent.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. Jackie from Grafton is our first caller. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I guess I just have a comment. Is I can remember or recall that in the past wars, World War II and I and the Korean War, we went to that country and we fought, and then after the war was over, we helped them with reconstruction. But now in Iraq, I see it differently. I see us fighting and at the same time working on reconstruction. And I just would like his comments on that, and I'll take him off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the question. Firstly, the fact that one's trying to do these two things at the same time is indicative of my point that you cannot see this paradigm of war amongst the people, in that nice serial fashion that one could in World Wars I and II, for example, where we, and this was our institutional thinking to this day, that we go from peace, crisis, war, resolution, peace again. What we are now living in is this world of continual confrontations within which these conflicts nest. And you are having to handle the two issues, those two objectives I'm talking about, confrontation and conflict, in parallel. And there is our difficulty, is to make those activities coherent.
Mm-hmm.
The second point I'd come back at you in your comment when you included the Korean War. The Korean War is the very first, in my estimation, and argued a bit in the book, the Korean War is the first of the wars amongst the people. And the reason for it is because not all wars amongst the people look like Iraq. We mustn't suppose that the example of Iraq is the fact of my paradigm. The Korean War, we started the fight We didn't start it, I'm sorry. It was started, we then became involved, with the object of uniting the Korean, two halves of Korea. The moment it looked as though China came in, I'm sorry, and it looked as though we might be having to use the atomic bomb, it was us that changed our objective. We, the United Nations, changed the objective, and we settled on finishing the war more or less where it started, on the line that we now call the demilitarized zone, which was, in fact, where the Russian forces came down from Manchuria and met the United States forces coming up from the south, who'd landed from Japan at the end of the Second World War. And there it has stayed. And we have had to maintain this condition ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reconstruction we've done is in the south, not in the north. And the confrontation is now a nuclear confrontation, not a... it has never gone away. We never resolved the matter
mm-hmm.
by force in 1952, when we finished on the demilitarized zone. And that's why I say it's the first example of the new paradigm taking place.
Let's go to Andy from Milwaukee next. Hello, Andy.
Hello. Good morning, General.
Good morning.
Thank you for your very intelligent thoughts. I'll try and form a cohesive question here. From what I'm sort of understanding from what you're saying historically until the somewhat recent past, military activities were activities from between and among nation states, for the most part, or at least what we would think of as war. Whereas now we have a different paradigm, and one thing I'm, you know, trying to wrap my head around is the neoconservative movement in the United States is greatly tied with the idea of nation building. And I'm wondering, you know, I was thinking neoconservative, this must be a new idea, partly because I'm naive about it. But in fact, maybe that's just a marketing tool to talk about a refusal to leave behind the idea that we are no longer dealing with nation states. Therefore, we have to build a nation in order to make it legitimate under our old paradigm.
Yeah.
And following that, you know, what is there a similar circumstance, or are you saying this is new? And if so, how do we change the momentum of the leadership in order to, you know, come into a newer age? Thank you very much. I'll go off.
Thanks for the call, Andy.
I think what's happening in the respect of the state, states aren't going to go away. We've had states in some form for a long time, and they change their character as communications change and warfare changes, and they make treaties, and this changes them, and so forth. And I think we're living through, although this isn't really my what I've written about, but I think we are living through a change in the form of the state.
Hmm.
We used to say nation states, but now you can see that in many cases states are breaking up into their constituent nations. We watch that happening in the Balkans, and so forth. And on the other hand, states are having to aggregate their sovereignties to some degree in order to provide for their people economically and so on and so forth. And we can watch that happening, perhaps the most advanced case being the European Union. And these are all new to us. So I think that's part of what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we need to have states because they're the basis on which our international law, they're the sort of unit of account, if you like, in international law. If you go and read the United Nations Charter and so forth, it is the states who are responsible. The states are the legal holders of the legal authority. It is states that have the authority, as it were, to use military force legitimately. And so what we need to establish is the ability for these political entities that have international status to function to a standard, to responsibly, and so forth. And when you get situations like, for example, in again the Middle East with Palestine, where they're not, the Palestinians are refusing to be a state, and this is extremely frustrating for Israel because Israel would like to deal with a state,
mm-hmm.
but for reasons which you can understand if you were sitting in the Palestinian shoe, they don't want to be a state because this would make them responsible for all sorts of things that they that would mean that they can't behave as they are now. And so there is a general interest amongst those well-established states, such as the United States, to try and make these entities behave as states, because mm-hmm. now you've got, if you looked at it like, you know, a small town, a responsible citizen on the street that you could deal with.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about religion in some fashion. You write in the book.
you're getting me well off my military brief.
But this is from your book, and I'm wondering how you deal with this. You talk about the current religious divide between the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq, and you say that there's nothing to suggest that it can be easily solved. However many coalition forces you send into Iraq, the Iraqi armed forces, supported by the coalition, are creating the divide. We have used the Iraqi security forces in trying to put down acts of violence, a predominantly Shia Iraqi force operating against Sunnis. Are we going to continue doing this? Because I don't see how this is going to make the Iraqi government be seen as the government of the whole of Iraq. This is a big issue, isn't it?
Yes, and it isn't something that you can resolve overnight.
Mm-hmm.
These are deeply rooted problems, and the solutions are you know, long in the cooking, if I can
mm-hmm.
put it that. You can't just sort of magic up an answer. There are various historical examples of where you've managed to overcome some of these differences. And I'm not suggesting they necessarily apply in the particular case of Iraq, but if you look at some of colonial history. You might have local forces based on individual tribes or clans, but you had an overarching officer and leadership of that force, so that was, as it were, pan society or pan the empire or whatever, so that there was evidence of there was some control of factional interests because the leadership was not factional. That might be a that's an example of where such a situation existed and people found a way around it. Now this didn't always work. Again, that always depends upon the society in question.
Mm-hmm.
In the story of that place we call Iraq, when it had ceased to be three different separate satraps of the Ottoman Empire and had become a mandated territory under the League of Nations to Great Britain, there the solution was, in part at least, to raise local levies, and the British administration took the minority group, the Sunni, and base the leadership amongst there, because of, and the general idea of that sort of thinking at that time was that by empowering the minority, you balanced out their minority status and therefore achieved a degree of balance across the country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a practical solution in today's circumstances, not least because of modern communications, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think about these things before you go in, because you've got to build,
mm-hmm.
from the moment you arrive, you've got to build your preferred solution to this matter, which is there to be observed before you go. It's not as though this should come as a surprise to you. The religion in question has been around
right.
for long enough to us to know about it.
General Rupert Smith is our guest. His book is The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World. He spent 40 years in the British Army and Senior International Command before he retired in the year 2002. We're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. General Rupert Smith, his book is The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World. And we go back to phone calls now. Daryl from Delavan is next. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and Sir Rupert Smith.
Good morning.
I have a question, sir. How significant is the language of war in creating war? And are we in need of a new paradigm of speech? It seems like the traditional form of speech and communication only digs the U.S. and England a deeper hole.
It's a very good question, and I think I must urge you to buy the book because I address this to some degree under the business of it being the theater of war. I don't think the language so much leads us into war. I think the language we use is based on the previous paradigm, and this gives us an understanding of what we're doing, which is false, and the explanation of what we see and hear going on becomes false. It is extremely difficult for a reporter, journalist, in their 3 minutes to camera or their 3 column inches or whatever, to get across what's happening in front of them without appealing to word pictures that are socially understood in the society they're talking to. And so by falling back onto the pictures of the past, the social memory, the folklore, that to describe something that isn't of that paradigm only adds to the confusion of understanding.
Hmm.
So I certainly think that's part of our difficulty. And the result is, of course, that then immediately the journalist or reporter falls to examining the individual case, the pity of war, if you will, and our understanding of the whole picture becomes less and less again. Is that enough of an answer? So I'm quite sure we need to recalibrate our language, but it's for the purpose of understanding what is already in front of us rather than to have a new paradigm of the language.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Daryl, so much for your call. Bob is next from Onalaska. Hi, Bob.
Thank you. Yes, I was wondering if you'd comment on this idea that maybe our... The way we fight war now is with a great effort to not involve the civilian population. And I'm wondering if that doesn't make our military ineffective. What I think happens is, like happened in World War II, people were so involved in the war that they were also very glad to end the war, and that became their primary objective. And they didn't have these objectives about whose religion was going to rule and so forth. And if perhaps we were less fastidious about not involving civilian population, people might be more interested in ending the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand you, what you're suggesting is that if we so terrorized by a military action, the people amongst which we were fighting that they decided that war, or rather whatever peace it was a better option than the war that was taking place. This would be a strategy that we could adopt. because that actually was what we were doing with the strategic bombing raids, both into Tokyo and other Japanese cities, and of course into Germany.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm happy to continue it. I think it's very important because the whole purpose of the opponent's actions in these circumstances is to conceal himself amongst the people, mm-hmm. is to get us mm-hmm. to, hit the people to the point that the people's will becomes his will.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to do that in the full view of the world's cameras?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let's talk about the world's cameras for a moment. You write when you, and we're not doing other parts of, you know, Bosnia and your experience in Ireland do justice here simply because we're absorbed by Iraq. But you talk about Bosnia being a true theater of war, and long before you arrived in Bosnia, you realized the crucial importance of the media in forming international public opinion and therefore their position in the conflict. Can you spend a little bit more time here and take the question in terms of how the press has been dealing? I don't see the British press very much, but the American press has been much more critical of this war in recent months, actually. And I'm wondering what it does to war, what it does to the conflict.
Oh, but the I think first of all, I would paint my picture, as it were, of this theater in which the commander in the theater are like a producer of a gladiatorial show in an amphitheater in Roman times. The difficulty is that you have at least one other producer in there with you with another team of gladiators, and mixed up with you are all the people who are late for their seats, the people flogging black market tickets, the ice cream sellers, and all the others.
Mm-hmm.
And all the way around in the stands are this global audience, this highly factional audience, who are being serviced, if you like, for their information by the media. And the media are what they say they are, a medium through which you are communicating. Now, as you quite correctly say, the audiences are factional. And in Milwaukee, you will see the United States media. And you will have noticed that it's always a United States victory and a NATO failure, or mm-hmm. Or the coalition got this wrong,
mm-hmm.
but it was our boys in the 108 Marine whatever who did the job.
Right.
And it's exactly the same, only the words change slightly, if we went to the London press or the French press or the Dutch or whatever. That's, as it were, the theater with a capital T that you're working in. And your business as the theater commander is to write the most compelling script and then act it out so that it is your narrative that everybody is following. And when that happens, you are winning. And again, if you want a very good example of this, is look at Israel and Hezbollah in July and August of last year, where if you actually look at the military activity, Hezbollah suffer considerably. And they lose their autonomy in the south of Lebanon, amongst other things, and they finish up having to apologize to the Lebanese people for causing the war that caused all the damage, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as far as the world's concerned, Hezbollah won.
Right.
And the reason they won is that they dominated the narrative.
Right.
And that's what is the nature, as it were, of command and that's the position that General Petraeus is in at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And Of course, his is enormously complex because he's got more than one other set of gladiators in there, and so on.
Let's go to Bob from Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen, in general. I'm wondering if in modern warfare, is naval power obsolete? You know, the United States seems to keep building nuclear submarines, and I can't think why. I wonder if you could comment.
Yes. No, I don't think naval or air power, for that matter, is obsolete. It's just as I don't think most of the weapons that we have in the armed forces are obsolete. It's the purpose to which you use them that is changing. And no doubt we need to only, I need a lot more research to be done to be sure what I did, but no doubt we need to rebalance as it were, the tools in the toolbox. We might need a few more spanners and rather less screwdrivers or whatever, but essentially they still have their uses.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655-227-2050. If you're joining us in the Milwaukee area, 227-2050. Can you talk just a little bit about the fact that the war in Iraq is increasingly and pretty soon now will it seems to me be America's war? Can you talk a little bit about what's been happening in England to determine the withdrawal of British forces?
British forces aren't withdrawing. There's a reduction of a little over 1,000, which, from my memory, you know, something a little under 7,000 is coming down to a little over 5,000, and the balance is going to Afghanistan. What you're watching is a small armed forces, about the same size as the United States Marine Corps, rebalancing its assets rather than a withdrawal from the war on terror, if I can put it that way, and deciding where its main effort is. The second, and I think perhaps more important point is that the setting. One of the things that most struck me when I was in America in January, when the book was published, was how much in America everybody sees Iraq as their war. This is something that we've got to sort out in America.
Mm-hmm.
The same conversation in Britain, this is not seen as our war at all. This is Prime Minister Blair's war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The questions I get are phrased rather more as, and what would you advise the Prime Minister to do?
Mm-hmm. Right,
than,
right.
What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Which is how they came when I was on the Eastern Seaboard.
Interesting. Tom is next from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I've always wondered, how does a high-ranking, intelligent-thinking commander resolve carrying out policy he may disagree with? How do you deal with that in your own head, you know?
I'm perhaps fortunate to have been in an army in circumstances where there is considerable latitude for argument and debate amongst its officers and the politicians and so forth. And I have not been in quite the stark situation that you describe. I cover one case in where I did actually sit and think, I cover this case in the book, and that was when we were about to start the bombing in Kosovo, or over Kosovo in, get my dates right, 1999. Was that right? Yes. And there I was very uncertain. This wasn't necessarily an effort that everybody was agreeing with. We certainly didn't have a United Nations license to do this thing. And here was I, the deputy commander of the force that was about to do this. And we did away with the defense of obeying orders at Nuremberg. And so I cleared my office and had a long think about it as to whether I thought this was something I ought to be part of. And I decided I should, on the grounds that if I was a strong man walking down the road and I heard someone screaming, a female screaming from a house, it was, and I'd formed the view that an assault and rape was going on, then it was my duty to break in and enter and possibly even to use physical force.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We are out of time, General Smith. Thank you so much for being with us. He is the author of The Utility of Force, The Art of War in the Modern World. It has just been published by Knopf. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, to John Treader for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.